Good evening, lovelies. Welcome to another episode of Coffee, Candy, and Creatives. My creative tonight is director Skye Wallen. Skye's latest project, documentary American Gadfly, chronicles the story of former Alaskan Senator Mike Gravel and his presidential run in 2020, something he was convinced to do by three New York teens after decades of retirement. We sadly lost Mr. Gravel this year. However, his progressive, forward-thinking ideals and values are still being worked on with passion and dedication at the Gravel Institute. American Gadfly will be available for streaming on all major platforms January 4th. This episode is sponsored by Be Unique Brevard, the Space Coast premier magazine. For more information, head to beunique.org, where you can sign up for your subscription and read it for free. Grab a cup of coffee or your favorite beverage, cuddle up with your host pup, and enjoy the show. All right, now we're recording. Welcome. How are you?
I'm very well. It's nice to see you, and thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I have to be upfront with you. When I was sent the screener, I knew like nothing about it. And I just started watching it and I thought it was some sort of like satirical, political, you know, kind of thing. I didn't know, like, this is real events. This happened. And it's such a funny story, because I'm constantly saying that kids are the future, you know, for better or for worse, right? They're gonna be the change makers. They're gonna be the ones making the decisions. And these three kids, I didn't catch their ages, but I'm assuming you filmed this a couple years ago.
Yeah, so 2019 and 2020 we shot. Okay. So they were 17, 18, and they turned 18 and 19 at some point.
Okay, so almost voting age or voting age. And hi, yeah. Skylar. And they're going to be the ones that are putting people into office that are going to be making these decisions that affect everyone of every age. And they found Mr. Gravel, and they're like, this dude seems cool. Let's put him on the ticket and see how far we can go with him, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it definitely seems a little stranger than fiction, I would say. And when I explain the movie to people, you know, they say, well, what have you been doing? I said, I'm doing a documentary about these kids who run a presidential campaign for an 89-year-old. And they said, well, did you write the script? How did you find the actors? I said, no, it's a documentary. Mm-hmm. And yeah, while it's a whimsical story, it's also kind of an incredible story. You know, the kids are now no longer kids, but it's hard to shake that. You know, I told them they will forever be known as the Gravel teens, no matter how old they are. But, you know, they're at the time when I met them, 17, 18 years old, I was just so blown away by how intelligent they are, how well read. You know, they've read volumes of political philosophy, and they're quoting Rawls and all these things, making me feel a little intellectually, inferior a little bit. But yeah, and ultimately they're driven by two things, I think. They have very passionate beliefs in, you know, how the United States ought to be operating. They have incredible compassion for people around the world, you know, for human suffering, I would say. But they also like to have fun. And the kids, they found a way to make a difference, try to run for someone for president, mainly as their objective to elevate their own beliefs, which are in align with Senator Gravel's. But throughout, they're having a blast the whole way. And it's kind of a fun ride. And you know, that, you know, the Washington Post reporter in the film says this, and I agree completely. I never got out of a conversation with them feeling cynical. And I think that speaks to their youth. But also, you know, they're trying to propose solutions to deep, deep systemic problems and having a really fun time while they're doing it. So it was a fun ride.
Right. And it's so either, I'm not sure if it's sad or funny, but you don't think that a 17-year-old is the place or the person that you're going to go to get that kind of insight into adult matters, you know? And it's so cool that you don't like this candidate. You don't like, they don't, like you said, align with your beliefs. Go find one, right? Go find someone who has, you know, the capability and the background that does align with your beliefs and convince them to run for president. And that's what they did.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they could have easily just tweeted and complained and moaned. And, you know, it's easy to drop into that. You know, I've been there myself, so I get it. But it's a whole nother ball game when you say, I'm going to try to jump in. And I know I'm not 35, I can't run for president, but there's a kind of way we can use social media and the new technology and use this sort of fervor from the public to jump into the arena ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, why not? And that's right. That to me, you know, beyond the politics of the whole story and beyond even the kids' politics, you can see a story about kids who were not happy with how things were going or that they wanted to say something. And so they decided to use the power at their fingertips and jump in and play with the big boys and girls, if you will. And they do it. And you know, they were never trying to win. You know, they were never trying to make Mike president. They were trying to make a big splash and make, get a conversation going. And that's what they did. And it's very inspiring.
A huge statement. Absolutely. Yeah. I think there's a common misconception that the younger generations are soft, that they're overly sensitive, that they're used to, what is it? I forget what it's called, but like where everybody gets a participation prize, you know, older people look at the younger generation like, and they're like, if you had to go to war, you'd be, you know, shit out of luck. If it was an apocalypse, you'd be shit out of luck, because there's this conception that, or misconception that kids are soft, teenagers are soft. You know, the younger generation, I hate the word snowflake, but that's like what people think. They think they're self-absorbed as well. And yeah, okay, probably a really good proportion or percentage of that population is like that. That's just a fact. That's just how it has to, you know, how it's been. But these kids, and I don't know, I mean, we could go really deep into their thought process, like, because they're from New York, right? Is there, you know, is it because of where they work? Is it a northern thing? Is it a New York State thing? Is it a red state, blue state, da 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 da? But what it all boils down to is, like you said, they wanted someone who believed the way they did, had the same goals. But now the kids are looking at decisions that Mr. Gravel made decades ago.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, they went back and when they learned about Mike and saw his positions from decades ago, and they were far ahead, you know, progressive wise and from the Democratic Party, you know, Mike was well ahead of gay rights and LGBTQ. He was way ahead of marijuana decriminalization, legalization, ending the war on drugs, way ahead on, you know, equity disparities, and war issues, you know, that I think Bernie Sanders has sort of popularized some of those aspects. And yeah, I think, you know, you can go back and find old headlines and old articles from many decades ago and find that the senator's positions are sort of where a lot of the voting part of the Democratic Party is today. I wouldn't necessarily say the elected officials, but, you know, I think there's way more of an appetite right now for Mike's old positions. And sadly, Mike passed away, but he was able to see the kids run the campaign and he got to see the documentary, actually. But yeah, I mean, the kids, they had a idea to shake up or to introduce different ideas into the Democratic conversation for the Democratic Party. And they saw the current front runners as not reflecting their views or their values. And they saw Mike Gravel, as explained in the movie, as a symbol or as an icon of a great leftist anti-war champion from, right. from the past, as the perfect symbol to carry their views into the mainstream. So they sort of, you know, obviously in coordination with Mike and with his permission and everything, they use him, they use his image and things he said in the past as a vehicle to start a new conversation. So, right. you know, that's sort of what their whole objective was. And I think, you know, obviously, spoiler alert, Mike did not win the presidency, but that
he
was
never,
yeah. I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. I know. Oh, I'm a walking spoiler. I'm terrible.
I haven't watched that episode yet. Yeah.
I know. That's season three. Sorry. no, but you know, what Mike said, you know, shortly before he passed was, my God, this has been an overwhelming success. And we've had people talking about issues that we care about for, you know, over a year. And that's huge. So I think that was their only objective. I think it was way more successful than they thought it would be. Yeah. And I think at its heart, it's really sweet, you know, beyond the politics, it's sort of this friendship between these young people and this silent generation, mm-hmm. Leftist champion, old guy in his twilight moments and twilight mm-hmm. years, getting to have another crack at the whip, if you will. And, mm-hmm. And just meet new friends and have one last roller coaster ride before he passed. Mm-hmm.
So he was way ahead of his time with his stances, as you said, with the gay rights and the right to, you know, medical marijuana and marijuana in general. And it's heartwarming and it's such a good thing that he still retained those beliefs, that he wasn't just full of crap, you know, back in the day, just saying what people, you know, what he thought people wanted to hear, because it was going against pretty much everything else, you know.
Yeah, Mike was, yeah. I mean, Mike definitely took stances that were not popular at the time. He alienated his colleagues. Mm-hmm. You know, when he read the Pentagon Papers into the public record, mm-hmm. you know, helping out Daniel Ellsberg and the New York Times, you know, he was the only elected official willing to do that. And I know some of his colleagues, even some of his colleagues who agreed with what he was doing, told him, you know, behind closed doors that, hey, you have a lot of guts. I, you know, if I had the guts you had, I would be doing that as well to help end this war, but I just can't do it. You know, right. It's just too polarizing. And yeah. And it just, you know, it speaks to a type of character that they're willing to lose their political career ultimately. Mm-hmm. And in the name of doing the right thing. And, you know, he ended up losing his third bid for Senate. And to be frank, the Democratic Party wasn't too upset about it. Right. The Republican Party definitely wasn't upset about it. But it's just, you know, sometimes it's hard to take a principled stance because you might in the short term lose a lot. But I think Mike's a great example for all of us that sometimes taking the right stance is just simply the right thing to do. And maybe one day, decades later, some kids will bring you back and you'll be, you know, sort of vindicated for the past.
Right. Well, the fact that he did it with disregard to his own success or his own career means that he was in it and doing what he did for his constituents, for the people, not himself. And can we really say that, not to go all, I mean, we're already political, but not to go too deep, controversial, political, but a lot of people in places of power, they don't have that mindset. They are in it for themselves. Yeah.
No, it's very rare to find a politician. And there's a lot of politicians that I want, politicians who I, you know, think are doing something good or whatnot. But yeah, gosh, I mean, it would be, I mean, I don't see many politicians speaking up in support of Julian Assange. you know, in the greatest attack on press freedom that I've ever seen in my lifetime. You know, Mike was very fervent about that. Just there are stances that are just not accepted by the establishment that it makes politicians weary and worried about their reelection prospects. So, yeah, I mean, I also, you know, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just saying, isn't that sad, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you got to be hopeful because it only took one mic, and you know, there's plenty of chances for people. But I do hope that some elected leaders will watch the movie and sort of, you know, maybe be encouraged by Mike's courage. And you know, you got to have hope. But I think we're entering an age where there's a lot of new technology. There's a lot of new activism happening. There's a lot of, you know, Steve Donziger, the lawyer who won a settlement from Chevron in South America. He, you know, had a huge he was kind of persecuted. It's a complicated story. You can look into it. But a huge grassroots effort, you know, came about from influencers and people on the left and the right online. And, you know, he was recently released from prison under house arrest. But you know, there's a lot of things, and the kids themselves, you know, in the campaign and the movie, they use technology and grassroots voices to their benefit. I think, you know, the establishment media gatekeepers, you know, Fox or CNN or whatever, you know, if anything, the trend is going away from them, and there's a lot of different voices who are vital to our you know, advancement of our, you know, ideals of actual freedom, not just lip service. So you know, yes, it's sad that there aren't more courageous politicians, but I remain optimistic, and if these kids can do this with just their Twitter feed, I think there's so much as possible coming in the future.
Right. Now, he did, he had a presidential bid, or he threw his hat in the ring in 2008, right?
That's right. And that's when I learned about him. So I was 17, 18 years old in the 07, 08 cycle. And at the time, you know, I was learning more about the war in Iraq, which was, you know, going south in a big way. And I was getting, you know, really interested in who's going to be the next president, because this is kind of the economic crisis was unfolding. And I saw Mike on the debate stage throwing rocks left and right. And he was also very funny. You can look up clips of him on YouTube, just really laying into the elected leaders of the time on the Democratic side, you know, about that they're not doing enough to end the war. They're not doing enough to fight climate change. He was proposing his own version of the Green New Deal at the time, advocating the end of all the war on drugs, which has, you know, vastly destroyed our inner cities and minority communities, saying a lot of stuff that you're not supposed to say. And I kind of fell in love with the guy, like, you know, as a kid, especially, it's just thought, man, what a bad ass, if I can say, I'm not sure I can say that, but
yeah, no, you can cuss, that's fine.
Okay. Total badass out there. And I always followed him, you know, through the next 12 years or so. And, you know, became a filmmaker and always had him in the back of my head. Like, I'd love to do a project with him or something, or maybe write a script about his role in the Pentagon Papers. And then all of a sudden I'm looking for a documentary project. And I see in the Rolling Stone, these kids have taken over his Twitter account and they're running him. So, so it was the perfect project. I got his number. I called Mike. I said, "Hey, this is awesome. We met five, 6 years ago or something." And I'm not sure he remembered me, but, and I said, "I would just love to be part of this." So I got in really early on before he even met the kids, and we got to, yeah, the rest is history. I mean, we got to film, I think we were able to film a entire, a microcosm of what a real campaign is, because the campaign was so small that we were able to kind of cover all the aspects of it in a really contained, tight way. So you know, beyond being just the coming of age, political coming of age of these kids and their friendship with Mike, I think it's also a good case study of a political campaign and the pitfalls and the corruption that you're up against and the media environment and all that. And I think we didn't really miss much, you know, from that whole story. You see campaign documentaries about, you know, Obama or whatever, and they're such huge campaigns, there's such huge operations that the filmmakers can only kind of get a little piece of it, but we were able to get it all.
Right, and you're getting the full story.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
The ins and outs and the minutia. So 2008, this wouldn't have been able to happen. The kids wouldn't have been able to reach out to him, because I think that wasn't that just like kind of the onset of the social media. Twitter was just a baby bird, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think they could have run this campaign in 2008. Twitter was definitely around, but it wasn't as effective as it is now. Yeah. And, you know, just how they were able, and just like the whole meme culture wasn't really as developed. Certainly it was there, but not in such a viral sense. Just the level of the memes, just the whole meme culture has just changed so much. It's just gone so far that just in my making of the film, I had to like go into all the meme bubbles, and there's all these different meme cultures. There's like the Yang Gang meme culture, which is very like techie, very, you know, sort of like, I don't know, they've got kind of a 80s Scarface techie vibe. You got the Marianne Williamson, who's an incredible person. She's got a very magic love sort of meme culture, when Mike's got his own kind of culture. So yeah, I think the internet culture had developed to a degree that the kids were able to wage an asymmetrical political campaign. And that's what this is. A campaign that strikes through and uses kind of guerrilla techniques to get something done or to win supporters. And I would say the most successful asymmetrical campaign of our time was Donald Trump, of course. But I think, you know, these are reflections of different types of, and I think there'll be more, and we allude to that in the film, that you know, there's going to be a lot more asymmetrical type campaigns because of social media. And I'm sure there will be efforts to clamp down on that by gatekeepers, I would say.
Right. And we have seen that the abuse that can happen with social media by people, politicians, people in places of power. So it can be used for good or evil, it seems like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a tool. And yeah, Mike always talked about, you know, government isn't good or evil. It is just a tool. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be used for both. And I think the same applies for social media. And, you know, a lot of things on social media concern me a lot. You know, a lot of things are very exciting about social media and the internet. I try to limit my social media time. But, you know, there is potential. I mean, they're tools. They're tools. Mm-hmm. You can use tools for evil. You can use tools for good. So
right. Absolutely. So he ran in 2008. How far did he get then? Because isn't
not
it
so
like,
far.
Isn't it like, break it down a little bit for people listening and me. Like, say there's 10 people and then they kind of have their little debate. Some people drop out just because, right? And then how does it get from so many people to one from each party?
Yeah, I mean, it changes different cycles. Back then, I think they were, if I recall, they were, you know, they wanted candidates in the later debates. I think they were more open in the earlier ones, but you had to be polling at a certain level. And Mike didn't poll, you know, up high enough.
Okay.
He didn't get any coverage. But also, it's all just determined by the committee, the debate committee. And that's
really
a mixture of Republicans and Democrats. Yeah, so they can decide who's in and who's out. And Mike was, actually, after I think the third debate he was in or so, he did overhear Howard Dean, who was the head of the DNC at the time, saying, we got to get Mike out of here. You know, this is not, he's got to be out. Because I think, you know, power doesn't like being questioned. And right. especially with someone on their own team, on their own stage. And it's like, we don't want to, we don't want to upset the status quo or whatever. Right. We like business as usual, and we want to, you know, bring a great candidate and beat the Republicans, for example. Right. I think the Republicans would be the same. You know, that I don't, I think at some point they didn't want that Donald Trump was succeeding. There was a sort of fragmented effort to stop him, but you know, unfortunately they stayed so fragmented that they couldn't do it. But you know, the Democrats were in this last cycle, they were able to come together to stop Bernie, for example. But yeah, it's very, you know, the debate process is very, it's very tricky. I think the Democrats did take a risk though, with the last cycle. And so how it differed, you know, you could make the debates if you got 65,000 individual donors. So 65,000 people that just donate $1 to your campaign. And they also had like a polling requirement. And it gets kind of complicated. We try to break it down in the film. But the reason why Mike was ultimately excluded was, you know, they actually qualified him for the debate, but there were only 20 seats available. And he didn't meet the polling requirement. So where he got 65,000 plus, almost 70,000, you know, people like de Blasio or John Delaney had a fraction of that, you know, maybe 4,000 donors, but they polled in more polls. So they got the preference. So, you know, I want to let viewers kind of decide what they think about it.
No, you're fine. It strikes me, and this is me speaking personally, it strikes me almost as like a reality show competition or like a talent show, or, you know, not the person that moves on to the next round or whatever. It's not necessarily the most talented, but got the most votes. Wow.
Right. Yeah. And one thing the kids said that really struck me and stayed with me was, it would be better if these debates, and I'm not sure how you do it, but if they required a candidate to excite people about a vision of the world. Mm-hmm. So real excitement. I think the individual donors count is possibly a good metric for that. But, you know, it's difficult because, you know, polling on the one hand seems like very democratic or very whatever, but the reality is, you know, polling, you poll better if you have better name recognition, if you're more famous. So, because people don't know who you are unless you're famous. So in that sense, polling is not really a good reflection of what people really want. So, you know, it's a tough call, but I do hope that the Democratic Party will be convinced to allow other people. You know, the movie also features Marianne Williamson, Andrew Yang, other kind of asymmetrical figures. You know, I as a citizen, I want to hear unique voices. Mm-hmm. You know, even if I don't agree with them, I want to have a conversation about our nation, the future, and that has to be, we have to open it up to more people than just trained lawyer politicians.
Absolutely.
Because I like to read philosophy and I like to read literature, and, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean I want a philosopher to be the president, maybe, but I think it's worth hearing from some of these people. You know, mm-hmm. if we're having a conversation, existential conversations about, you know, how do we clean the planet? How do we stop a nuclear war? How do we save democracy? Because some of my greatest lessons have been learned from talking to elders, you know, really old people, and sometimes very young people. But, you know, I feel like elder statesmen, you know, it would have been beautiful to have Mike up on the debate stage, even just to say, you know, a few words from a wise old man, even though, you know, he's not actually going to be president. So, yeah.
Well, to me, when it comes to the polling and it comes to the 65,000 people put their money where their mouth is. To me, that's more impactful. That means, to me, it means this person has more support from the people, right? Because anybody can, you know, click on a vote or, you know, whatever for polling. But, and yeah, it's only a dollar. Okay, whatever. But the point is that means more to me, I guess, because I don't know, it just means more to me.
Yeah. You know? I mean, this, and a lot of people are not, they're not wealthy people. They're regular people, regular folks. And yeah, I mean, it's an actionable event to give someone a dollar.
Right.
Or more, you know, whatever, but even a dollar, you know, so many people asking you for money on the internet. And in life, you know, in capitalist society and all that, it was really beautiful. I mean, when the kids actually got to the 65,000 and they called Mike and we filmed the conversation, and he just, the joy that, you know, almost 70,000 people, you know, were excited about him, about his vision, about his ideas, wanted to see him up there. Right. You know, steamrolling other more famous candidates. I mean, he, in terms of donor count, he obliterated the sitting mayor of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's quite something. Right. And I think it is a pretty good indicator of grassroots, real, true democratic belief mm-hmm. in someone. And right. those people that gave him a dollar, they probably didn't expect him to go on to win, but they wanted his views to be spoken on that stage and him to be able to challenge the front runners and everything. So I feel like, you know, if we truly want to be a democracy, we need to cultivate these types of things, not stamp them out.
Right. Absolutely. And it, you said the sitting mayor of New York City, how many of your residents, you know, put their money towards somebody else, dude? You know, it's like, you got to think about that. Got to think about how, what your, you know, your choices and what you're putting forth, how your residents, your people believe and feel about it. And then mm-hmm. go from, because if you don't have the support of the people, you really probably should not be the most powerful man in the United States or woman in the United States, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's kind of an existential question of our nation, because there's plenty mm-hmm. of countries throughout history or nation states or empires that they did not operate under a democratic system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, do we want to be that, or are we trying to continue this experiment? And yeah, I mean, these are serious, tough questions. I'm not sure we'll be able to answer them, but right. you know, we're scratching around it. You know, this is what we do. We create content or art, or we ask questions. We meet people. We're trying to advance a real conversation. And yeah, I mean, I think all Americans should be concerned about this stuff.
Right. And at the heart of the documentary is these three kids that didn't do it for clout. They didn't do it. I mean, they were excited when things went viral, but that wasn't their initial reason for doing it. You know, they mm-hmm. they didn't want to be the number one TikToker, you know. They did it because they had a firm and solid belief. Sorry, I was waiting to see if the dogs barked. Okay.
No worries. We're good.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Sorry, I'm a little mischievous too.
That's all right. There's a little there's a little dog, and she's pretty demented. And by that I mean she's old and has dementia. But no, we don't want to get her going. But no, these kids had this solid outlook there on the future and on the present and on the environment and all of this stuff. They didn't do it to, you know, to get the clicks, to get the likes for themselves. And it's kind of rare to see a young person not be serving when it comes to social media or, you know, the internet and things like that. So, yeah. I mean, that's at the heart of this is three young men, kids, as everyone's calling them, having a vision, you know, a healthy vision and how they want their, and where they want their country to go. And like we talked about earlier, decades old, you know, speeches and what was it? And then the Pentagon Papers and things like that. And they just ran with it. And he just looked, and Mr. Gravel looks so tickled. You know, he just looks so happy and so pleased. And I love when they asked his wife, Whitney, and she's like, oh no, I'm not, I'm not happy about this at all. Or I'm not looking forward to this at all. And it seems like she came on board there, you know,
oh, yeah.
as it went on. But so you said that Mr. Gravel, actually, he saw the documentary before he passed.
Yes, he was able to see the documentary sort of, we had a virtual premiere. We're sort of still, mm-hmm. we were in sort of still a big COVID time at Ashland Film Festival, where we won the audience award. So he got to see it. He got to know that we won the award, and he voiced his appreciation for the film, and he was pretty jazzed. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, even just, I got to speak with him a couple days before he passed away, and he just felt so content. And he was just, the boys really brought him on such a beautiful ride. I mean, I don't know, when I'm, you know, 90 or 91, mm-hmm. and if I got that opportunity to take one last crack at a big high adrenaline life not? Adventure, I mean, God, yeah.
Why and, not?
And yeah, and it was just, you know, Whitney. I think Whitney was fully on board pretty quickly, but you know, her concerns were legitimate and real. You know, she was worried about Mike's health. She was worried about the economic, you know, potential impact on their family, because they mm-hmm. went through a presidential campaign. It wasn't a great time. You know, it's a very emotionally straining. But you know, their rules were, well, first you got to convince my wife, which they did, mm-hmm. just with their intelligence and their sensitivity to the whole thing. And second of all, Mike doesn't leave the house to campaign. Mm-hmm. He's only leaving the house if they get him into the debates. You know, he wanted to save his energy. So yeah, I mean, he ran I forget which president he just ran. He ran a whole presidential campaign on his porch. Mm-hmm. So he basically did that, McKinley or something like that. But yeah, and it just went exactly how it was supposed to go. And you know, Whitney talked to me. We had a celebration of life for Mike in D.C. recently, or a few months ago. You know, they're very happy to have this movie exist. They're happy that the kids are continuing their work at the Gravel Institute. And just to circle back to what you were saying about the kids not really wanting to be front and center, mm-hmm. it's so true. I mean, it's becoming more true now. You know, they don't want to be, you know, they're putting out a lot of content trying to educate people about issues that they care about, but they're trying to elevate other voices. You know, there's many men and women who are being, you know, sort of put in the limelight, people that are not necessarily having a big platform. They're giving people a platform to speak their truth. And I think that's a beautiful thing. You know, you don't really see them in any of their videos. And I'm the lucky one. I caught them before they really had fully thought through those ideas of mm-hmm. more anonymity and stuff. So yeah, I'm incredibly proud of them. I mean, look, it's exciting to go viral. I think anyone wants that. And of course, mm-hmm. you see it in the movie when they start going viral, they have this giddy, you know, kid fun. Yeah. They're having a blast. But, you know, they're mature enough to understand the higher goals. And You know, I think that's key. We can't get, nobody should get too caught up in trying to go viral, because, you know, going viral is fleeting. Sight.
Yeah.
It's a fleeting.
You lose sight of your goals. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then you just, it becomes kind of like a drug or something. And it's a fleeting accomplishment, I would say, you know.
Right.
It's not bad. I'm not saying it's necessarily bad. I'm just saying. No, but
it is like a sugar rush, or, you know, worse, a cocaine rush or something like that. But where you get addicted to the fame of it. Yeah. So did they know that he was he sick when you started filming? Or was that discovered later on? You said she was worried about his health just because of his... Okay.
Well, he had neuropathy, so he had no feeling in his feet. So he had trouble walking and standing. But, you know, we were really lucky that, you know, he was incredibly sharp. And he would get tired after I was interviewing for hours. Who wouldn't? But
exactly.
Yeah. But he, you know, it's really special. We caught him in a really special time. It's kind of the end, the last few years, but he was very active, and, you know, he was driving and picking the kids up at the airport to meet them and stuff. And he was super jazzed for interviews, and they were like an adrenaline rush for him. And he was just so excited around the house and thinking of new ideas. And then, you know, after the campaign ends, the kids proposed to him, we'd like to start a Gravel Institute to keep this going past, you know, well into the future, trying to create an institution that will last this, the test of time, stand the test of time. And they got him on board on that. And then he got super jazzed again. And we had all these ideas and, you know, ideas about governance and objectives and goals. And he was able to put out a book, one last book about direct democracy, which was his most important issue to his heart. And I'm a softie, and I just, you know, kind of tear up thinking about, you know, just makes me a little weepy about thinking, man, like, what a great friendship, what a great time for the Gravel family and these kids. And I was lucky enough to be part of that, even just as an observer. So, right. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, he was excited and engaged to the very end, it sounds like. And not a lot of people can say that, not especially if older people, not a lot of people can say that they were living every second until the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he had this incredible life, and he thankfully kept his wits, you know, till the end. But I mean, you think about this kid, a son of immigrants, drives to, you know, Alaska, becomes the youngest speaker of the Alaskan House, runs for Senate, becomes one of the youngest senators in the United States, takes on the Nixon administration, ends the draft, reads the Pentagon Papers, thinks it develops a whole direct democracy legislation. This kind of disappears for a little bit, comes back, runs for president 2007, and then runs for president again with a group of teenagers, and goes viral. And I don't know. I mean, that's a life well lived, if I've ever heard of one.
Right. So he was a senator for Alaska, you said, but he was not originally from there?
Massachusetts.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
I believe he was born in Springfield, Massachusetts. Okay. And yeah, he wanted to get into politics, but the Kennedys were just totally, you know, totally in charge of that whole state.
Yeah, forget about it.
So he thought, oh, I'd move to Alaska, where it's a new state. And so yeah, I mean, he was probably pretty smart in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and Alaska is a very beautiful but very, very harsh place. So I feel like, you know, made him tough, made him, you know, that's awesome. Oh, yeah.
I mean, the toughness of New England, then mixed with the toughness of Alaska, Mike was a super tough guy. I mean,
oh, yeah.
But you know, before I met him, all I knew him was from his YouTube videos where he's yelling at Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton for not ending the war. And so I was a little scared. I wasn't sure if he would yell at me or what. Right. But it was I was very young when I first met him, and I don't know, I was intimidated, I guess, by one of my heroes, but a very tough guy. And the opposite was the case. I mean, Mike is the warmest guy and was so full of generosity and trust. You know, his wife, his entire family, they've sort of welcomed me in, and they're beautiful people. They really, really believe in love. They're not very religious people. But they're religious about their love for other people and trusting other people. And I never thought I would become Mike's friend. That was a big surprise for me. It was awesome. I mean, it was really a special thing and changed my life for sure.
When you started out writing, did you have like an idea that this was where you might end up, like doing a documentary on a politician?
I mean, you know, when I graduated college, I had a lot of ideas of exactly what's going to happen in my life. Turns out you can't really predict that stuff. I was always interested in documentary work. I jumped into, you know, doing documentaries with different activist groups and environmental groups and scientists and stuff, and, you know, worked with Mark Ruffalo for a period. And, you know, so I've always been interested in that space. I've also written fiction, and I was working on a variety of fiction projects as the 2020 cycle was starting to begin. Mm-hmm. And I thought, man, actually, I can potentially get some capital and get this going a lot faster than a lot of my fiction ideas. Plus, I want to get involved, and I want to try to make a difference in the very serious times. So, did I expect to be doing a documentary about Mike when I did? Not really. I was always interested in doing a story with him, or writing a script about his life. But it sort of fell on my lap, and I was already looking for something, to get started quickly. And I would say that, documentary has a lot of its own, it has a lot of unique issues. It's very, it can be very difficult. But one easier part for me was getting started quicker. I mean, with script writing, I've been writing a script for 12 years, and I'm about to rewrite it. That's a different, it takes a long time to get those scripts right. And I would say that, I don't want to say it was easier. It wasn't, I don't think it was easier. It has a lot of different challenges, but I would say that I was able to get it going a lot quicker. So, but again, I just saw in the Rolling Stone this story, so it sort of fell in my lap.
Right. But conversely, depending on your subject matter of your documentary, you could be working for years. I know of a couple filmmakers about this $1 million stamp collection, and no joke, 6 years they followed the story and the subject and the subject of the documentary. And I was like, six, holy cow.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, and I was actually
patient enough.
No, these projects take so long. This took 3 years, and that's pretty good. That's pretty lucky. They say like 7 years, but it always varies. But yeah, the water project, and I followed scientists at dozens of water disasters, oil spills, chemical spills, water poisonings, chemical spills, and we have a lot of footage, and I couldn't get it put together, so I had to kind of put it away. We're now revisiting that project, but I started that in 2012, so I do understand the flip side. I mean, I was very lucky that when I saw this story, I was thinking, okay, there's a timeline of the story, the campaign cycle. So there's mm-hmm. a finite period of time. I can actually cover this story and I don't know what the ending will be, but I know when it will be.
Right.
So that helped with scheduling. I know when the presidential debates are scheduled. There's only a certain amount of time within that frame. And then we'll probably have some epilogue work after the presidency is determined. And yeah. And, you know, on top of that, you know, we were so blessed and lucky that we shot our final scene March 2020, right before Super Tuesday, right before mm-hmm. the lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
We filmed at the last big Bernie Sanders rally right before Super Tuesday. And we got to shoot a scene with Bernie and Mike together. Yeah. And literally days later, lockdown happened. So we spent the whole COVID editing. And that, you know, I'm glad we had shot everything, obviously. I mean, we had our problems were the smallest in the grand scheme of things, but
it's still a problem, still valid.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we adapted. I was able to work remotely with my editing team, and mm-hmm. you know, it all worked out. But right. Yeah, I mean, filmmaking is tricky business. Mm-hmm. Writing a book is a tricky business. I know people are writing books for decades, so it's mm-hmm. it takes a lot of patience. But you know, there were times where I wanted to give up, not on this project, but in the past, and I'm glad I didn't, and you know, persevered, learned from my mistakes, and man, you need patience, and I'm not a patient person, so
right. So you mentioned Mark Ruffalo, and I could have tried to look it up real quick and try to be smart, but did that have to do with the water documentary? Because I feel like he was is heavily involved in a specific charity, and I want to say that it's about the water.
Yeah, so my docuseries that we're going to be starting to edit in the new year, it's not all about him or at all. I mean, we crossed paths and we were aligned, and I worked with his organization, which is no longer, but we were able to document some incredible stories about small towns, about water contamination, about science. So yeah, Water Defense was his group. Okay. And back, you know, a few years ago. But yeah, I mean, that's one we'll be telling that story, but it's really mm-hmm. about a lot.
Hi.
Sorry, sorry, my thing went weird. It's really about a lot of bigger topics. I mean, you know, we'll learn about what happened with Water Defense, and you know, a lot of great work was done over the years. And yeah, I mean, we're gonna take episode by episode. Will be about a specific water topic. So oil spills will be one.
Or like
algal blooms.
Flint, Michigan. Yeah.
Flint. And we're going to focus on solutions and really try to explain the science to people in a easy to understand way.
Right.
Yeah. So that's one of the main topics that we're going to explore.
That's awesome. And it is a hot topic as well.
Yeah.
Or at least it seems to be, because we're going to get off target or off topic here, but
sorry.
We need water. We need clean water. You cannot get around. You can't get around the environmental problems. I'm sorry. You can stick your head in the sand about pretty much anything else, but this is all we got. We need water to live. You know, we need food, and we need trees to give off the oxygen. And for people to be so, you know, blasé about the environment, no, it's really super important. So I love the fact that your next project is clean water and water issues. Definitely.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
No, I mean, it's so important. I know we're off topic, but it's so important to me as well, because what I'm trying to do is go local and mm-hmm. look at the impact in a non-political way, and just showing science, showing pollution, and talking about solutions. So I think you know, people get polarized and they turn on MSNBC or Fox and they get upset about the Green New Deal is socialism or the it's not enough or, but, you know, to me, it's all a lot of it's noise. Look at what's happening in our backyard. It impacts everyone. It doesn't matter red or blue state. I mean, we interview, you know, people who voted for Trump and there's lead in their water and their baby's sick and she's the mom is sick. You know, they care about a lot of people care about these issues, you know, so trying to get out of the politics aspect of it and just get to, you know, what's the problem? What's the human impact and how we solve it?
Right. Absolutely. So. I mean, Mother Nature doesn't give a shit about your political affiliation. Okay.
No, not at all.
Oh, we're getting close on time. So where can people see American Gadfly, which, by the way, I'm so glad you put the definition at the beginning because I thought it meant something totally different. But it's a stimulus. It's a fly that bites and goads animals, right? And it's a stimulus and it gets things moving, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a big fly that bites livestock. And, you know, Plato called Socrates a gadfly of the Greek society. And it's, you know, when it's referred to, you know, you can think of livestock as the establishment, for example, that is ignoring the impending doom of their society. And a gadfly is a figure who questions them and, you know, speaks truth to power, often says what other people are thinking. And they're often, you know, they're often criticized and alienated by elites and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was the perfect title, you know, for Mike, you know, but yeah, we come out January 4th throughout North America. You can find us on almost all the streaming rental platforms, Amazon, Vudu, YouTube, iTunes, Apple TV. It'll be on VOD on a lot of cable providers. And yeah, I mean, we're really excited for the launch. And I think we're going to get a good reception. The boys and I will be speaking at South by Southwest with Marianne Williamson in March as well.
It sounds good, Sky. It's been so wonderful talking to you.
Yeah, I like this longer form. You know, we can actually kind of talk.
Absolutely. And you know what? If people don't want to listen to an hour-long show, that's their business because they're going to miss out on some good stuff.
Yeah, I love the longer form content. So
right.
Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah, if we go off on tangents, I'm totally fine with it.
Yeah, no, we got to do it. There's a lot of things I like to talk about, not just the 4-minute soundbite about the film. So I appreciate
the opportunity.
You know, there's plenty of that.
Absolutely.
But, well, thanks so much. So nice talking to you.
You too. Have a great night.
Bye. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this creative conversation. Be sure to follow me on social media. I am Pup Duffy basically everywhere. You can follow the show on Facebook. It's Coffee, Candy, and Creatives. Head over to beunique.org. Like, follow, and support my beautiful humans over there. Be sure to check out my sponsor. And for your own sponsorship or interview opportunities, please email me at pup4ccc@gmail.com. If you like the music you're hearing, head on over to RaleighKeegan.com and do yourself a favor and buy this album. You can download it or you can have a physical CD. You can also keep up to date on tour dates and future releases. As always, take care of each other, love each other, watch each other's back, and I'll see you next time.